Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, Mark Schindler is in the building. We're going to talk about a terrific Warriors-Lakers game one that featured a number of really interesting adjustments back and forth, that featured some interesting strategies that I want to break down, and that featured absolutely bonkers things occurring throughout the course of it, including a final 29-foot three-point attempt from Jordan Poole that I think only Jordan Poole thought was a good idea on planet Earth. So we're going to talk about that. Oh, also Tyrese Halliburton thought it was a good idea based off of the clip that's going around from the Watch Along show that happens on Twitter every night. Then we're going to talk about Knicks Heat, which was a weird game that did not feature Jimmy Butler. That was an incredibly well-coached game by Eric Spoelstra. I want to dive into some of the sets that Spo ran throughout the course of that game. I had to do it. I apologize, Mark. I know that you were not looking super excited to doing that with me, but we're also going to talk about RJ Barrett, which is something that I know Mark is super excited about talking about, because RJ has been really, really good over the course of this last little playoff run. Finally, we're going to talk about two newsy and notesy kind of things that occurred over the course of today, including the fact that Dylan Brooks will not be a member of the Memphis Grizzlies next year, according to my colleague over at The Athletic, Shams Charania, as well as the fact that Joel Embiid is the league's MVP this season. And some of the reaction to that, which I hope was mostly just positive, because Joel deserves to be a league MVP. I don't think that anybody can argue that. But they will. Mark, what's going on, buddy?
Today was a long day. It's been a good day, but yeah, the final fourth quarter. Like, I think we had two really good basketball games today. But that fourth quarter was why we stay up for games. That was really fun, but also some chicanery in that. So that was there was a lot going on today. I'm excited to dive into it, man. How about you? How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I got to show Laura one of my favorite movies on planet Earth last night. She had never seen Michael Clayton, and it was great. I enjoyed it.
That's one of your favorite movies. I want to guess it. It is. That's one of those I feel like I need to go back and watch, because I saw it when it originally came out, and I was like 12 or 13. And I remember enjoying it at the time, but I think I would actually get it a lot more now. I remember all-time really good Tom Wilkinson performance in that.
Tom Wilkinson's very good. Tilda Swinton is incredible in it. And George Clooney is incredible in it. It's just, it came in like the craziest Oscar year ever, where it's There Will Be Blood, it's No Country for Old Men. Like, that year is just absolutely bonkers in 2007. It's, to me though, probably, I don't know that it's more impressive as an achievement than like There Will Be Blood, but I enjoy it much, much more than There Will Be Blood and No Country. Like, I think that Michael Clayton is basically a perfect script inside of perfect performances and perfectly directed film. Got to show Laura it last night, and I'm super excited to have gotten to show her that. But people are not here to hear me talk about Michael Clayton. They're here to hear me talk about the Warriors-Lakers. The Lakers win this game 117-112. A really interesting back and forth game, it felt like to me, where in the first half, I thought that the Lakers generally, really even for the first three quarters, it felt like the Lakers generally got better shots than the Warriors did. And from really probably the beginning of the third quarter onward, it felt like the Lakers were at a solid 10-point lead throughout. And then the Warriors adjusted defensively a little bit in the fourth quarter, tightened things up. Over the course of the last 6 minutes, the Lakers scored 5 points. Two of those were on free throws at the end of the game with, I believe, 2.7 seconds left as the team, as the Warriors fouled to try and get an extra possession. So realistically, 3 points in the final 6 minutes for the Lakers, because the Warriors absolutely turned up the screws defensively and twisted it, and it was a phenomenal game. But the thing that is most important to take away, I think, from this game is that for as good as Kevon Looney was again, and he had 10 points, 23 rebounds, 5 assists, the team in this game did not have an answer for Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis goes for 30 points, 23 assists, 5 or 5 23 rebounds, 5 assists, 4 blocks, 11 of 19 from the field, 8 of 8 from the line. Anthony Davis was the guy in this game. He was the best player on planet Earth in this game, in my opinion. Like, this is the idealized version that everybody wants of Anthony Davis. He's the reason they win this game. And we'll talk about some of the things that I think the Warriors did that were interesting and some of the things they could do later in this series to adjust to Anthony Davis. But it was a phenomenal, phenomenal game from Anthony Davis. Is that your biggest takeaway, Mark?
Yeah. I think that would be my biggest takeaway. And part of what was fun too is I think that the Warriors very much came out with this and said, okay, AD beat us. And he did, like, based just on how they were playing defense on him. Like, that, everything they were doing was trying to deter drives, you know, be active to keep them, you know, having to play out of the pockets. And AD was awesome in that. It wasn't even just the shooting. Like, I thought his passing was really good today too, on a level that we don't always see. Like, when he was drawing help, he was making great reads. Like, there was a really specific one. And part of, like, I love the way that the Lakers scripted in cuts for their guys who were not really getting respected as shooters. And AD took really great advantage of that for them. And then the defensive end, I thought part of what was special tonight and where you could really see the difference. Like, I think the other thing that stands out, and a lot of that goes into AD, is them really being able to exert their size on the – Sam is missing. There we go. Okay. Them really being able to exert their size on the Warriors. Like, they very much felt like the bigger team against the Warriors tonight, and I thought that was huge because, you know, Sacramento had some really great defensive performances against the Warriors because of their quickness and their ability to switch and their ability to play, you know, really push things far out on the perimeter. And I thought the Lakers were able to play well defensively tonight because they were able to keep things out on the perimeter with their size on the interior and how well they were able to kind of navigate some things with that, while also doing some really great things on the perimeter as well. But yeah, that was a really special AD game. We didn't even mention a stat line: 30, 23, 5, and 4 blocks. That was an awesome performance from him. You are muted.
I'm a nightmare, folks. Here we go. I think that I'm glad you brought up the defense first, because I do want to talk about that first. You bring up a really good point that the Lakers kind of did the exact opposite of what I felt like the Warriors did tonight defensively. I expected to see the Warriors try and keep everything out of the paint and try to make it so that the Lakers had to beat them as a perimeter shooting team. Now, that is difficult when, for the reasons you said, they looked bigger than the Warriors tonight. But as we've seen in the Heat series, you don't always have to be bigger than the opposing team to try and dissuade dribble penetration and to keep a team out of the paint. The Heat are much smaller than the Knicks, but they're able to do it through scheme. I expected the Warriors to do that. They did not. I also kind of expected the Lakers to try and do that, and I thought they were really successful over the course of this game. They make the Warriors shoot 53 three-pointers. The Warriors made 21 of those threes. All of Steph, Clay, and Jordan Poole ended up with at least 6 threes made in this game. I'm going to go through, kind of while we're talking here, to figure out how many games there have been where a team has had 3 players make at least 6 threes in a game and to lose a playoff game. I can't imagine that it's many. I can't imagine that there are many opportunities where a team has made 20 threes in a playoff game and lost. Like, there are probably precious few of those over the course of playoff history. Now, the Warriors took 30 or 53 of them, and where I think the Warriors were successful, or where I think the Lakers were successful, was completely shutting off the paint on drives. This is something that the Warriors had an immense amount of success against with the Sacramento Kings, being able to pull DeMontis Sabonis, Trey Lyles away from the basket and then being able to slice and dice with cuts with a lot of their passers and playmakers, right? It felt like there was always a help man down around the basket for the Warriors in this game, which I think made it much more difficult for the Warrior, for the Lakers, which made it much more difficult for the Warriors to be able to get into some of those actions that they want to run, bringing Looney and Draymond away from the basket and being able to find open cutters around the rim. It's going to be really interesting to see how the Warriors adjust to that piece of it, I think, offensively more than anything else, because this is not a great dribble penetration team. Like, the Warriors don't have these explosive athletes that are just going to be able to be a walking paint touch, kind of like an Anthony Edwards or someone like that. They're going to have to live by manufacturing paint touches. And they did that in the Kings series really, really well. Yeah, I'll be intrigued. That's where I'm intrigued to watch, I think, moving forward.
Yeah, I think, you know, kind of like you just mentioned, you know, Clay, Steph, and Poole all going off for six threes. All of them shot well from three tonight. But exactly like you mentioned, I think part of what made this work so well for the Lakers is that, like, they did some things aggressively on defense, but particularly with, you know, AD, they were doing a lot of just playing more center field, playing a little bit close to the level of the screen, but not all the way there. And that was a big reason for why the Warriors end up all three of those guys end up shooting well below average from inside the arc. Like, Steph was, I believe, 4 of 11 inside the arc, one trip to the free throw line, and it was on an and one. Jordan Poole, one of four inside the arc. Klay Thompson, 3 of 9 inside the arc. Like, it's not all just Anthony Davis, but a lot of that was Anthony Davis in the way that they played with. Like, I thought Dennis Schroeder had a fantastic game tonight. I loved what they did sprinkling him in and getting him going as well, and what he brought as a chaser. And then I loved Jared Vanderbilt. They kind of took a little bit of a page out of what Sacramento did by pressuring Steph, you know, 94 feet with using Jared Vanderbilt as somebody to be on him the entire time. And I thought one of the adjustments that I, not even adjustments necessarily, like, I thought that, like, it's always easier said than done to just, you know, avoid something that another team is doing. But I thought the Warriors kind of played right in the Lakers' hands by letting them pressure Steph as much as they did. You know, I thought they were very content to just say, okay, well, we'll just play him off the ball and run him off the ball. And I thought that was a really big struggle for them early on in the game. Like, they, not that they quote unquote took Steph out of the game, but I think they took away a lot of, you know, getting the most out of his gravity and initial actions and plays, because the Lakers were, you know, when you put somebody who's 6'8", who was really active, and, like, I mean, Jared's mobility always stands out, of course, but the energy was, like, just unreal tonight. He was frenetic. Even like they were really airtight on switches, and there were a couple of late switches that happened, but for the most part, they were really good at, okay, we're just going to show and then have him recover over top. And they were able to negate so much like that. And again, like, it's a lot of what, like, Sacramento did, but they just have so much more size in what they were running. Yeah. So they're able to get away with a little bit more in those pockets, or there's a lot less room for Golden State to navigate with that. And so I think I'm interested to see how aggressive they are coming out next game and making sure that Steph is getting going early, because so much of what made the Warriors offense flow late was, oh, hey, we really need to make sure the offense is running through Steph. And And I do want to say too, just because I know it is the talk of the town right now, could the Warriors have gotten a couple more free throws? Maybe, but it speaks to where their shots were being taken from. Like,
that's right.
I get really frustrated with that happening all the time. Like, yes, do I think that they could have had more than six free throws as a team? For sure. I don't think that they would have earned much more than that because of where they were taking their shots and how things were challenged. Like, I can't get there. That's what your shot profile was. So, I just wanted to get that out of the way really quick, because I've seen way too much of that already.
Yeah, as we kind of talk here, I'm kind of, my screen is in front of my monitor. So I'm like kind of looking here to see how many shots the Warriors took in the restricted area. It looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 or so, something like that. Not too many shots in the restricted area, which is going to lead typically to circumstances where you don't draw free throws. If you're not getting that dribble penetration, you're not putting yourself in the line to draw free throws. The other piece of this, you know, I said I was going to look up this number while we were talking or while Mark was talking. The Warriors became the seventh team in NBA history to lose, having made 21 threes in a game, in a playoff game. They are the first team to ever have three players make at least six threes in a playoff game and lose. That is wild, and that is actually a little bit worrisome if I'm the Warriors. Now, the thing that heartens me if I'm a Warriors fan is it did feel like throughout this game, and this is where we're going to kind of dive into tape after I get Mark's opinion on this, it felt a little bit like they were trying to experiment with some different kinds of coverages throughout this game. You know, sometimes they use, and the biggest way that you can do this is the way that you use the help man. We've talked throughout the playoffs against teams that play guys like Jared Vanderbilt, non-shooters that you, if they shoot threes, you're more than comfortable with it. You can either use your defensive player on Jared Vanderbilt as a proactive help defender. Think of the way that the Warriors typically use Draymond Green. They used him like this in some ways tonight. Or you can use that guy as a reactive, you know, whatever you want to phrase it, more of just a hiding help defender, which would be what the Warriors did tonight, for instance, sometimes with Stephen Curry on Jared Vanderbilt, where instead of trying to get the most out of a help defender, you're actually kind of sitting there and maybe letting Stephen Curry get a little bit of rest, some active recovery from having to sprint around on offense and carry the load offensively the whole time. It was interesting to me to see the way that the Warriors went about that. And it's also very interesting to me that the Warriors tended to have their most success, actually, I felt like, defensively later in this game when they went a bit smaller with Jordan Poole in the game for Kevon Looney. What do you make of the Warriors' defensive performance tonight, Mark?
It's a good question. Like, honestly, I felt that it was mostly fine. I think, like, again, a lot of it came down to, like we mentioned, how well AD played within the confines of how they wanted him to play. But I think, like we hit on earlier, I do think that they could have done a lot more in trying to make punish the Lakers for playing some of the guys that they were playing. To be fair, I thought Jared Vanderbilt did a really good job of doing as much as he could to be, you know, an active part of the offense. But I still think, like, looking all around, it'll be interesting to see how much more they look to crunch down the paint moving forward. Like, I don't think that they need to play as far out as they did on a lot of guys tonight. So that'll be interesting to see how they adapt to that. Like, I make Dennis Schroeder shoot as many times as he freaking wants to from outside. Like, easier said than done. Like, again, like, there's rescreens exist for a reason, but also so does going under the screen and fighting through it. Like, you know, there's two sides to every story with that. So, it's not like an end of the world thing for them. I don't think, you know, giving up 117 points, I always think it's important to keep it in context to what that really is right now, because, like, that's league average offense, so it's not the worst thing that's ever happened. But also, I looked at this game and I was like, I wonder if they're gonna get any kind of run from Kuminga moving forward, because I do think this needs to be a series where he or JaMychal Green really play. Like, I kind of liked the JaMychal Green minutes. It wasn't perfect defensively, but I love the idea of what they were doing of, we need somebody out there who can be a pick and pop threat, because that's all they wanted from him. And it did work against the Lakers. So I wonder if we continue to get more of that with how they're playing. But yeah, it was exactly like you mentioned. It felt like the Warriors came out to experiment a little bit in this one, and the Lakers came out to win this one.
Yeah, and we're going to kind of dive into tape here, and I'll explain what I mean by that experimentation. So the Warriors tonight did end up, it was exactly 100 possessions defensively for the Warriors tonight. They ended up at a 117 defensive rating per the NBA site. That would be, you know, bottom five in the league. That's not a great defensive game from the Warriors. You know, the 2 points difference from league average, but still not a great defensive game by them, I felt like, throughout the course of this contest. And we're going to kind of go through now what I mean by experimenting in terms of just different coverages here, right? So on this one, what you're going to see is that Draymond Green is on Jared Vanderbilt here. And by on Jared Vanderbilt, I mean, he took a very quick glance in terms of his peripheral vision to see where Jared Vanderbilt was going as he kind of drove by him and then moved to the corner. But he is sitting here in the paint, just ready to be the help man on this Anthony, or is this a LeBron James post up? I believe it's a LeBron post up. You're going to see here the Vanderbilt kick out happens, and Dre just doesn't move. Like, Dre does not care. It was surprising to me after the way that this started that we didn't see more of this throughout the game. And by more of it, I mean, like, basically every minute that Jared Vanderbilt was on the court, I kind of expected the Warriors to do something like this. But as you'll see throughout the tape, they did not. Here, what you're going to see is that Stephen Curry is actually on Jared Vanderbilt here. This is only at like the 8 minute mark of the first quarter. That previous possession was at the 9 minute mark of the first quarter. This is now at the 8 minute mark. Steph shouldn't need this active recovery moment, right? Like, they've been playing for 4 minutes. You would not expect Steph to like need that blow to sit on Jared Vanderbilt for a possession. But what you're going to see here is that Steph is on Vanderbilt and they're going to kind of come through. They're going to run just this little kind of rub screen, you know, action for Vanderbilt, for LeBron, with Vanderbilt setting the screen. LeBron hits Vanderbilt on the roll. And then Draymond Green, who is on D'Angelo Russell, I don't want to say Dre is ball watching here. He's not really ball watching. And he gets the like kind of side view contest, but he's ball watching a little bit and he's a little late to get there. And it ends up being a wide open D'Angelo Russell shooting pocket, shooting lane at least. And Draymond gets the late contest on D'Angelo for sure. D'Angelo drops 19 points and 6 assists in this game versus only 1 turnover. It was a good game from D'Angelo Russell. But that's the kind of thing that you're missing. If this is, you know, Draymond Green on LeBron James here instead of, or if this is Draymond Green on Jared Vanderbilt here, I just assume they switch this action at the end of the day, right? And they just have, you know, Andrew Wiggins move on to Vanderbilt here. And that's a thing that they're going to be more than comfortable with. Instead, Steph has to go and recover, and it ends up being kind of a wide open three. It just completely changes the tenor of the defensive possession when that is the case. So again, you're going to see here, Stephen Curry is the person on Jared Vanderbilt. Jared Vanderbilt just kind of gets leverage on him. And instead of this being Draymond as the help defender, whenever I don't think that Vanderbilt would be able to drive in this scenario on Stephen Curry, but B, if he does, even instead of this being Stephen Curry, it'd be Draymond Green as the help defender there in the basket instead of Stephen Curry. And that would make life a little bit harder, I think, overall. Now we're going to see this possession kind of run through. And again, eventually Draymond ends up down there, but like, he has to be paying attention to D'Angelo Russell in like a pretty substantial way. Like, he can't come up and put two on the ball here against LeBron James, because if he does, D'Angelo is just going to sink over to that corner and it's going to be an open three for a guy that's a 40% 3-point shooter on open 3-pointers. So I don't love the idea of them having Stephen Curry on Jared Vanderbilt. And I actually don't love the idea of them having Draymond Green on D'Angelo Russell, in all honesty. Like, I think that there are just better defensive matchups in this series. So here, this is going to be a thing where you notice Draymond Green is actually going to call out to Dante DiVincenzo. They're in a transition scenario here where you're trying to pick up the guy that you can. Look at Draymond Point. He's pointing to Dante, get over, get over. I've got Jared. You're on Dennis here. So here, he's basically saying, like, look, I've got Jared. Let me be the guy that sinks off of Jared here so I can help onto LeBron. By doing that, he kind of sinks Dante into the passing angle, and Dante is still in good proper guarding position against Dennis. And this ends up being a turnover because they're just basically packing the paint in such a substantial way there. It's kind of a hard pocket pass to hit. Again, I love Jared Vanderbilt, or I love Draymond Green as the help defender on Jared Vanderbilt. I think it's really their best move moving forward. So here, this is just a little bit different because it's Wenyen Gabriel on the court. And when Wenyen's out there, you kind of have similar incentives, in my opinion, to be able to do some things. But again, this is Draymond Green on Jared Vanderbilt. And again, the paint is packed. If this is somebody else, you might see that this could have been a driving lane. Instead, Draymond Green is sunk off of Vanderbilt. I wish I had a pointer. And he's just floating square in the middle of the lane. Because he's floating square in the middle of the lane, this ends up being like a shitty elbow jumper from Dennis Schroeder. Dre missed the block out. But at the same token, I think that that's a good shot, and that's what you're looking for offensively. Now, again, what you're going to see here is that Steph is on Jared Vanderbilt. And look on this possession. This is that last one again. I have to let it run through. Because this is basically an empty side action, and because they have Steph hiding on Jared Vanderbilt instead of having a proactive help defender on Jared Vanderbilt. And again, I think this is Draymond Green actually guarding D'Angelo Russell here. If you just have Steph on D'Angelo and you have Draymond Green on Jared Vanderbilt, you can sink Draymond Green into the paint here in this empty side ball screen action that's going to come. Dribble handoff, I'm sorry. And instead of just having Steph stand there, you would have a real rim protector around the basket here. Easy dunk for Anthony Davis. Again, these are just the kind of small things that I think we're going to see change throughout the course of this series. I'm not saying that, like, I think the Warriors did a terrible job here or anything. I really do genuinely think they were experimenting with different things throughout the course of this game. In this scenario, what you're going to see is that they actually moved later in the game Draymond Green onto Anthony Davis. And then when Kevon Looney was on the court, they actually switched Kevon out onto Jared Vanderbilt, which I think is a really interesting strategy. By doing that, you now essentially have Kevon Looney, who can cut off this driving angle on LeBron James in help, and he can be in that little passing pocket there to be able to get the turnover, force the difficult spot from Jared Vanderbilt there. And notice again here, Draymond Green is going to fly over as well and just kind of be a nuisance here and help off of Anthony Davis. It's kind of an aggressive move, but Draymond Green is one of the best help defenders in the NBA. I would utilize him like that in this series. That would be my goal. If I was the Golden State Warriors, I would want him in these circumstances where Jared Vanderbilt is on the court, Wenyen Gabriel is on the court. I think that you could do a lot of really intriguing things by forcing Draymond Green just to be that help guy rotating around like crazy, as we've seen him do throughout the course of his career. The adjustment for the Lakers would be don't play Jared Vanderbilt. You start Dennis Schroeder with Austin Reeves, D'Angelo Russell, LeBron, and AD. It's kind of what I expected to see early in this series, to be completely honest with you. But that didn't happen. And I think the Warriors let Jared Vanderbilt off the hook a little bit, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I mean, as you pointed out, I think I'd be in the same boat with that. I'm interested to see what they do in game two.
Yeah, it's going to be really, really interesting to watch throughout the course of this series. And just in terms of the adjustments, I loved the Warriors late in this game. Actually, defensively, I thought they did kind of condense the paint a little bit more, even though they went smaller. I thought that it was just really interesting to watch all of this occur in real time. These are two really, really high level teams, really interesting basketball coaches. Darvin Ham has been hit or miss throughout the course of the year. Steve Kerr, you know, I think sometimes can be a bit slavish to scheme, but in this game, he was experimental and it was fascinating. Where do you think we see this series go from here? Did this game change anything for you in terms of how you believe this series plays out?
I mean, I think that I don't want to say that the Lakers threw their best punch. I think it was a really great performance all around. And especially with how well AD is playing, that has been, you know, that's the blueprint for what they want to do. But I also think that you saw some things that if I'm the Warriors, I feel good about. I feel pretty good about, and I don't want to, I think it's always tough to figure out how to parse the root, because like, he's still arguably the greatest player of all time. This was not a good LeBron game, in my opinion. I think that he did a lot of really good, impactful things. Like, I thought he was good defensively tonight. Obviously does the stuff in transition that's really important. But the I was talking about this with our friend Zach Milner today about what your decision making can look like. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a bad decision maker, but what it looks like when what you want to do with the ball in your hands doesn't match what you can think through and process in the game. And we're seeing that with LeBron this year, especially since he's come back from that foot injury. Like, he clearly is not the same getting downhill. And that's led to, like, I mean, watching him take these possessions where, like, they were up 3 or 5 in the last minute, and he just dribbles out the entire clock after bringing the ball down. And like, that's just, it's so vexing and weird for me to watch as somebody who's, you know, grew up my entire life watching LeBron find the best possible shots, be this dominant clutch player who is so good at creating late clock. And I mean, I want to run the numbers on it. It feels like his late clock offense has been pretty awful by his standards this year, at least over the last couple months. And I genuinely, like, I think that there's always, that there needs to be a blend between, you know, efficiency and confidence in shooting. But with where he's at as a three-point shooter right now, I don't know, man, because some of the shots, it's not like, it's not even shots that I think the defense is reacting to. Like, it's, you know, I'm going to gun this early pull-up three in transition with 2 or 3 seconds off the shot clock. And just with where he's at right now and what it's looked like a lot of the year in taking that, I don't know. I don't want to be too harsh on it, but I do think when I look at that, if this is like we know that LeBron is going to have a better game moving forward. And again, like, still had a good game today, but it just, when you're talking about that level of that level of impact, it's not, you know, what you're accustomed to or what it could have been. I do think that the Warriors can do some things to really try and be like, hey, you are resorting to these tendencies. Like, it's not just a one game fluke. What can we do to really try and force you to be in this different zone? Because even like some of the turnovers he had were just like really forced. And like, that's been kind of the thing for him this year, which has been weird to watch. Like, it almost feels like a regression in how he's as a playmaker. And that's not to deter from him. But like I spoke about earlier, I think when you see somebody who's he's not able to get everywhere on the court in the way that he has been capable of in the same way. And it plays out in his decision-making a little bit. And I am interested to see if the Warriors try and do anything to really play into that, because I mean, if you take away some of those things, I think that it looks really interesting moving forward.
Well, and I think that what you're saying is something that I've been saying throughout the playoffs a little bit. I don't think his first step is what it used to be. Like, look, that's Captain Obvious statement, right? He's, you know, 39 at this point, right? 38 years old, doesn't turn 39 until December, but it's harder for him to get that consistent dribble penetration in half court settings. He can do it in the full court, he can get that freight train mentality going and get downhill and like really get moving. But I think in the half court, it's a little bit harder for him against help defenses that like kind of come in and kind of put two on the ball on his drives for him to get all the way to the basket. And because of that, he's still adjusting, in my opinion, to, okay, I can't get all the way to the rim. My dribble kickout game is still not quite where it can be, right? Like LeBron, over the course of this playoffs, I think he's like right around 5 assists a game, which is low for LeBron, right? And it feels like to me, it's because that, you know, dribble drive kickout game is just not quite where it has been. Like LeBron so far in the playoffs, I think is something like 5 assists versus like 3.2 turnovers or something like that. For a guy like that, it's abnormal at the very least. And I think a big part of it is because it's a little bit harder for him to get that dribble penetration. I do just want to shout out, you know, I talked a little bit about Jared Vanderbilt's offense or lack thereof. You know, Rasen Chaudhry here brings up a really good point. You know, Jared Vanderbilt causes so much chaos for a Warriors team that relies on timing and passing and is prone to turnovers. That's 100% right. His ability to kind of wreak havoc in passing lanes, his ability to wreak havoc getting around those dribble handoffs, getting around all sorts of different on-ball actions for Steph, I think it is a real factor for the Lakers in the series. And being able to keep him on the court is going to be really important for the Lakers, including being able to maintain that enormous size that Mark and I talked about at the top here. That is a big reason they can play as big as they do. That, again, though, is why, in my opinion, the Lakers or the Warriors need to really hammer him whenever the Warriors are on defense. Yeah. They need to really make it so the Lakers are not getting anything out of Vanderbilt offensively and, in fact, are being hindered by Vanderbilt offensively in this series. And it felt like they did not take enough advantage of that. That is their adjustment, I think, moving forward. Just being able to really, really hone in on that and make it harder for Vanderbilt to be out there. Mark, this has not changed my opinion on anything. I think this is a 7-game series. I think this is one of the best series we're going to see in the playoffs. Certainly one of the best we've seen in a while, to be honest. Do you have anything else to say about this?
I think it goes 6. I don't think it goes as I still think like Kings Warriors is like one of the best playoff series I've watched in my lifetime. I don't think it's going to be better than that. I think it's still going to be a very good playoff series, but yeah, I think I'd probably lean 6 in this one.
And you would say Lakers then?
No, in either way. I think I'm not going to make a determination until after game 2, just because I want to see how a team adjusts. But yeah, I think just that's just my feel on it. I could be completely wrong. That's mostly just vibes.
Yep. Well, the vibes are important, Mark. You can't deny the vibes. Speaking of vibes, Jimmy Butler's vibes are typically immaculate, but they were not tonight. Let's take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to talk about the Miami Heat and Jimmy Butler not playing in their game against the New York Knicks. Okay, we're back, Mark. The New York Knicks defeat the Miami Heat tonight in a fairly ugly game that was 111-105 at Madison Square Garden. It was enjoyable, don't get me wrong, but it did feel like an incomplete game on some level because we did not have Jimmy Butler in this game. And frankly, Julius Randle had moments where he looked phenomenal, and you look at the final stat line, he goes for 25 points, 12 rebounds, 8 assists. I think he certainly played well, but he does look a bit tentative on the ankle as well, it feels like to me. And I'm going to be really interested to see how he pulls up from that coming into game 3 of the series in Miami. What were your overall impressions of this game as you watched it unfold?
I like you mentioned, I think just adding Julius brings that other factor for the Knicks offense. I think a couple things. I've been a little bit bothered by how much, or bothered maybe is a little bit too strong, but like the Knicks are really struggling to get into the paint on a team that I don't think they should be struggling into the paint as much as they are. And Miami's getting into the paint way easier than they should be. Like Kyle Lowry was, even if like, again, like his box score wasn't anything crazy. But I thought he had, especially in the second half, he had some really great stuff getting into the paint, and it was on contested drives. Like he blew by Quentin Grimes a couple times, who, to be fair, came off injury, has not completely looked right on either end of the court. And I'm hoping that he can get right because the Knicks need him to be. But especially with like it's not like the Heat are generating tons and tons of rim pressure, but it's enough to get them going and get to their shots the way that they need. So I think to me, the way I looked at this game was very much I feel good that I won if I'm the Knicks, but also, boy, we need to clean up some things before Jimmy Butler comes back, because I think that obviously it's not always 1-1, but even if you have some good things to take away from in this game, I think that there are some things that are going to need to be cleaned up, moving forward that were present in game one as well.
Yeah, big news. The good news for the Knicks in this game, I thought, was that they made 40% of their threes. They went 16 of 40 from three. Jalen Brunson got back, you know, going again, which was really, really important after game one. He goes for 30 points, 5 rebounds, 2 assists on 10 of 19 from the field, 6 of 10 from three. Was a really, really terrific player tonight, especially in the second half for the New York Knicks. We're going to talk a little bit about RJ Barrett. He goes for 24 points, 3 rebounds, 3 assists in this game as well. He was the only negative player in the starting lineup for the New York Knicks, which, as always, is very intriguing to look at in terms of what the plus minus is during games like this. But I saw nothing in this game that makes me think the Heat aren't the favorite moving forward. They have home court advantage now. They're probably going to get Jimmy Butler back, we would think. I can't imagine
that Jimmy Butler is. Can I give you my reason for why the Heat aren't the favorite?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not saying that I think I would still pick the Knicks to win this series. It's Bam, man. Like, I think Bam's defense was awesome tonight. I'm not going to take that away. Like, I thought in terms of somebody, like, I tweeted this out, like, just a masterclass in sticking in front of people. Like, he is so good at not biting on pump fakes. The way, like, I thought that the Knicks did a much better job of trying to get not – drag Bam into actions in the second half, and that helped open things up for Jalen Brunson. But part of Brunson's struggles in the first half were like, yeah, we're getting Bam involved in actions, and that was confusing to watch. And believe it or not, Jalen Brunson really struggles to drive and score on Bam Adebayo. I mean, he went 1-6 in the first half, was really struggling to create separation. Part of that was their guards too, but I thought Bam was awesome. But I mean, his offense in the playoffs has just been really disappointing to watch. Like, again, that's not to put it completely on him and make it completely his onus, but especially with how much, I mean, Mitch Robb was in foul trouble most of the game tonight. I think he picked up his second foul like 3 or 4 minutes into the game. Ends up just only playing 20 minutes tonight. And not like Hartenstein's a bad defender, but for what Bam can do, I do think like it's just frustrating. Like I think that there are like it always comes back to the same things, and it's not the exact same, but it's a lot of the same stuff as like with looking at Miles Turner and the Pacers. Like, you got to create your own offense at some point. This is not a we need to draw up plays for you. This is okay. You're running handoffs. You're running delay sets. You are controlling the ball. You are doing things with the ball. And yes, you're creating shots for teammates, but also you're the best player on your team right now. Like,
yes,
they need you to go create shots. Even if it's not like something perfect, I think him getting into the lane or trying to draw fouls or doing anything, getting downhill with where they're at right now would be monumental for what they need. I mean, they took 49 threes tonight and it felt like they needed every one of them. And I don't know, like, I'm not trying to hit him too hard with this. But it's been a thing the entire playoffs. And I think if I feel if I'm going to feel that the Heat can win the series, I think that they need a lot more from Bam offensively than taking 10 field goal attempts in a game, because he's capable of a lot more.
The scary thing is I don't think they need more. if Jimmy Butler is playing, I don't. Like, I think that we got a Jalen Brunson explosion tonight in part because the adjustment that the Heat made in game one was not on the table. They switched Jimmy Butler onto Jalen Brunson in game one in the second half, and Jalen had a miserable time with it, right? It made it a little bit harder for the Heat in this game, not having Jimmy Butler, to field high-level defensive lineups consistently. High-level two-way lineups consistently, let's go with. Like, they had to play Haywood Highsmith 15 minutes in this game. Haywood Highsmith's actually, like, a really good defender. It's just that he is – you have to really manufacture anything to make him viable on offense in any way. Caleb Martin plays 38 minutes tonight.
He was good, too, I thought.
And he was good, yeah. But Duncan Robinson plays 21 minutes tonight, right? You replace 40 of those minutes with Jimmy Butler, right? Like, that's a substantial upgrade both on offense and on defense, even with Caleb Martin being as good as he is on defense. Part of this is that I just really trust Eric Spoelstra. I'm like fully in the fucking bag for Eric Spoelstra at this point. Yeah. Some of the things he did in this game, and I feel like we're giving the Knicks the short end of the stick here, and I apologize for that. But like, some of the things Eric Spoelstra did in this game, let's just like pull up the clips to be able to talk about it. I just pulled like four or five, just basically ATOs or sets that the Heat ran to be able to create different opportunities throughout the course of this game. And this one here is really fun. So you're going to see Duncan Robinson cross through the entire set here. You're going to see Cody Zeller just like kind of act like he's going to set a super high ball screen, but not really. And then what this does is throughout the entirety of this set, because you have your man on the weak side here, I can't tell who that is. That might be Haywood Highsmith, just essentially blocking off Quentin Grimes here as a screener. If Gabe Vincent turns the corner on Emmanuel quickly, it's over. And then you're essentially in a one-on-two where that's actually Haywood Highsmith in the corner. I can't quite tell who that is. That might be Kyle Lowry setting that screen.
I'm pretty sure it's Lowry setting screen, yeah.
Yeah. You're basically putting Obi Toppin in an impossible situation here. You're stressing Gabe Vincent to turn the corner if you're Eric Spoelstra here. And this is just fantastic, right? Like, this set puts Obi Toppin in an impossible spot. Highsmith gets the open three. Bam. It's just money. This is a beautiful ATO here, right? You're going to see again, they're going to develop something for Haywood Highsmith again. Going to kind of get this ball here into Bam. He's going to set this screen for Duncan. And you assume, because Bam Adebayo and Duncan Robinson throughout the course of their careers have had just immaculate synergy in dribble handoff settings, even down in the corners or on the wings, you're going to see here, it's going to come back and you're expecting just this little screen here for Bam to be able to flip it to Duncan and be able to make a three. And the Knicks know that that's coming, right? The Knicks see that coming, which is why Obi Toppin flies toward Duncan. I guarantee that's on the scouting report, because that's what Duncan Robinson does, right? This is Eric Spoelstra playing off of the scouting report here, countering what the Knicks are trying to do. Just creates a wide open driving lane for Haywood Highsmith. Get the contest there from Quentin Grimes. Really good rotation from Quentin Grimes. Deserves credit there. But because he had to come off Kyle Lowry, Kyle Lowry ends up getting this easy bucket. Here's another one that's really fun. And you're going to see two back-to-back really fun things here. So a lot of what the Heat tend to do on the backside is they'll try and maybe run like a flex cut toward the basket off of like Kevin Love coming down, or they'll have Kevin Love come down and set a pin down. But what you're going to see here is that Jalen Brunson comes up and he's just like top locking Max Strus. He's stopping Max Strus from being able to take that little pin down action and come across or come over the top of it and get this open 3-point opportunity. So instead, what Max Strus does really intelligently, he just goes down, instead of flex cutting, he just sets a screen on Kevin Love's man. Wide open three. Wide open three for Kevin Love. This is a counter to exactly what the Knicks are doing to defend. And what you're going to see here on this next possession, which occurred, that that last one was the last possession, I believe, of the, or is one of the last, or no, yeah. That was the last possession, basically, of the second half, or of the second quarter. This is going to be at the 9:40 mark of the third quarter. Jalen Brunson no longer top locking Max Strus on these backside exchange actions. And you're going to see here, Bam Adebayo, he's going to be able to get into that handoff set for Max Strus. Here's the thing. In these situations, the Knicks are very clearly being told you have to get out onto the shooter, which is what Mitchell Robinson does. Bam just keeps it in this circumstance, gets down, drives the lane. I think that there is so much more room throughout the course of the rest of this series for Bam Adebayo to specifically play the keepers on dribble handoffs because of the way that Mitchell Robinson is going to be forced to play him throughout the course of this series, right? Because of the way that Mitchell Robinson is playing shooters, because of the way the Knicks are playing shooters, I think there is so, so much that Bam can do off of these actions, particularly in order to take advantage of the Knicks defense here. Just really manufactured a lot of shit. And I think that once you get Jimmy Butler back, it becomes even easier to manufacture stuff because of the amount of attention that Jimmy Butler will end up getting from the opposing team. I just, it's hard for me to believe, given the way that the Heat have been able to manufacture offense throughout the series, both with and without Jimmy Butler. I think it's been much easier for them at this point. And additionally, I think that their defensive scheme in terms of being able to pack the paint, I don't trust the Knicks shooters. Do you trust the Knicks shooters? That's kind of what it comes down to, right?
I think I do. And like, it's not even about the, like, no, that's a good point. I think it's less about the shooting to me and more just scoring overall. Like, I think the biggest disappointment for the Knicks in the playoffs, and to be fair, like, he's still been very good defensively. He's done a lot of really important stuff with moving the ball and getting offense going, but they need Emmanuel quickly to be the scorer that he was throughout the season. I think that that's the biggest difference maker moving forward, because their bench units just haven't hit the same with him not being that level of scorer.
Well, and if he's not that guy, they don't have the ability to adjust and go smaller, right? Like, lineups that they've loved to run throughout the course of this year, they love to have these Jalen and quickly lineups out there with two wings and, you know, Julius Randle, or two wings and Mitchell Robinson, but it's typically Julius. If you don't have that adjustment in the bag because Emmanuel isn't playing quite as well as you need him to, you're then looking at something like when you want to go to those small lineups, it's, you know, Jalen Brunson, Josh Hart, RJ Barrett, and Quentin Grimes. Quentin Grimes has this shoulder injury right now that, you know, I think kind of has him a little bit tentative as a shooter. RJ Barrett's knocking down threes, as we're going to talk about. That's a really big factor here. And then Josh Hart went 2 for 4 from three tonight, but Josh is not the most confident shooter from time to time. So it's harder.
I mean, he took three of those threes in the last 5 minutes of the game, and he had so many opportunities that he passed up to. So exactly, like, it's very fake 4 threes.
Yeah. So to me, schematically, I still think Miami has the advantage in this series based off of what I've seen. But the Jimmy Butler injury factor is a real thing. I think getting Julius Randle back in this game was enormous in terms of the rebounding battle. A big part of the Knicks' success in the Cavs series was being able to just absolutely hammer the Cavs on the defensive glass or on the offensive glass. In this series, it's a little bit harder because the Heat are a top 5 defensive rebounding team in the NBA. But if you have both Randle and Robinson attacking the offensive glass constantly, I think that they are much bigger than the guys on the Heat, and you can do as well as you want to boxing out. If you have guys that are just going to be able to move you like big adults, like Mitchell Robinson and Julius Randle and Isaiah Hartenstein tonight, he had 4 offensive rebounds. I think that there is a chance that they can get those extra possessions and make it a little bit harder. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about RJ Barrett, though. What have you enjoyed about RJ Barrett in this playoff run, Mark? Because I have loved to see it.
Yeah, everything. I think like you kind of mentioned with the plus minus, I think part of that was they wanted to get him rest, and they ended up playing him with the bench unit a lot. And the bench unit, as we mentioned, has kind of struggled. So I don't take too much away from it. Not that you were saying that there's much to take away from it, but he was really like their only source of offense that was consistent in the first half. And part of what's been awesome about watching him play in the playoffs is he's just letting the game come to him. Like, so much of what has been the RJ Barrett problem for me, problem's probably too harsh, but like just the issues with him has been like, you see the complete intrigue and allure of everything he can do, but it just feels like everything is forced. Everything feels stiff. And the jumper has really came and went. And luckily it has been here in the playoffs, and he has been willing to uncork and let it go. Finished with 9 attempts tonight, hit 5 of them. The biggest thing though has been, I think, the decision making and overall like feel for what to do and the flow of the offense has been perfect. Like it's not anything like groundbreaking. It's just, okay, I'm big, I'm strong, I can get to the rim. I'm going to move the ball when I draw to. I'm going to make a proactive play as I see it unfold instead of forcing something. He's been good at hitting cutters on the baseline. He's been good at hitting guys in the dunker spot. And that stuff, like, it's simple stuff, but it's stuff that he really struggled with at times this year. Like, there were times where he didn't even look at the dunker spot, or he didn't even look to make corner kickouts. And, like, he's such a good driver and somebody who's strong enough to really just put his shoulder down and get in the lane that if he's just making the simple passes and with timeliness, that's perfect for him. And I think you put that in with he has kind of figured out how to slow down a little bit. And like, he's been really good with deceleration in the playoffs. I felt like there's been so much stuff with him where, you know, he's getting offensive fouls because he's a little bit out of control on drives, or, you know, he just isn't quite on balance. And I think at least in the playoffs, it really has felt like he's kind of had that down pat with, you know, how to be in control in the lane. And like there were some imperfect moments early on in the Cavs series with him on post-ups, but I think he's done some better stuff of being quick with his post-ups, because I think when he is doing back downs and trying to get into his post-fade game, that's where I feel less confident in his post-up game. But when he is catching, getting into a jab series and ripping quick, like, I think that's where he's really good. And I think we've seen him do a lot more of that. I want to see him do that. Like, he did some of that in game one and it looked good. It wasn't really as much of that tonight. I think there can be more of that moving forward, but it's just been a lot of putting everything together a little bit. And it's been very fun to watch. And the defense has been good too.
Yeah. I think the defense has been really good. I think that's really important. I think throughout the, you know, especially the middle portion and later portion of this year, it felt like his defense, particularly off the ball, was messy. Let's go with inattentiveness was there, and, you know, lack of awareness and reactivity was there. And it was a little bit frustrating. But one thing that Mark Jones mentioned in, I think it was game 4 of the Cavs series, maybe, was that between game 3 or maybe it was game 5, you know, somewhere after game 2 of that series, Mark Jones said that RJ Barrett really got in the gym and actually adjusted the shooting pocket on his jumper a little bit to the left. So let's kind of dive in, because I went and found a shot from very late in the season. I think it was like their 80th game of the year against Orlando, where we're going to see here that RJ Barrett is going to take this kick out kind of in the corner, and you're going to see the shooting pocket is like kind of straight above his head, it feels like there. I do think there is a little bit of also, if you look at the way he's loading as well, it feels like his gather is very twisted, like toward his right a little bit. And it is a little bit interesting to see, because when that happens, you can have a little bit too much offhand interaction. You can have a number of different things. Your elbow can be out of alignment. There are a lot of different things that can happen. So this is going to be a missed shot here. Orlando is going to get the rebound, et cetera, right? So let's take a look at tonight. So this is a pretty good look at it. Basically the same spot. And what I think I'm seeing here, at the very least, I don't know about you, Mark, is you're going to see him catch. It feels like he's bringing the ball up more from the left side of his body, and it is helping him keep his elbow in alignment a little bit more underneath the ball. I'll run that again for you. Are you kind of seeing the same thing?
Yeah, it's a much more clean straight up and down motion instead of something going, you know, like 45 degrees across, which I think has been an issue for him. And I think you saw that in all the shots tonight. It's all just like going straight up with it. I really like you pointing that out.
Yeah, it just feels a little bit smoother to me in terms of the shot, which is important. And the shot comes at 10:30 of the first quarter. We're going to get just an RJ explosion here coming down. This is going to be, I believe, another three from RJ on a double team kickout from Julius Randle here. The thing I really love about this play, this is the kind of shit where it's just like Josh Hart, fucking beautiful, man. I love Josh Hart so much. Josh Hart recognizes what's happening here. RJ's man has sunk in, and Josh's own man, I believe, is the player that went to double on Randle here. It was Bam. It was Mitchell's man. And because of that, Kevin Love has to kind of like sink in a little bit, be prepared. And then look at Josh Hart. Josh Hart is going to cut here, which is going to open up the entire thing, because he cuts. RJ's man has to tag him as a cutter, and it's going to open up the entire right side of the court for RJ. It's a really, really smart play by Josh Hart there. And again, I think body looks in so much more alignment here in terms of the shot. Like, I really think that there could be something to this in terms of him being a bit of a better shooter right now. This is just really important. I think the Knicks, in circumstances like this, where they have the Miami Heat defense bent in some way, their players taking these kickouts or taking these reversals need to be willing to attack that gap. They have to be willing to do it aggressively and confidently. I know you're driving into Bam Adebayo. This is perfect. This is a beautiful little floater by RJ Barrett. Makes it. You have to be aggressive here. You have to be willing to attack those gaps, because those gaps are not presenting themselves that often in this series because of the way Miami is sagging and helping off of guys. So here, again, this is just a corner kick out. The ball is just going to get to RJ Barrett. And again, you're going to see things look so much more just aligned and simple. The shooting pocket does look a little bit moved over to the left. I think Mark Jones was on it, man. Mm-hmm. I think this is absolutely true. And then you're going to see here, this is a kick out. And I just love the strides. This is always the thing that RJ has been able to do, and where I thought he was going to find his most success in the NBA. These strides, this stride length, these powerful strides, that's him turning the corner on Haywood Highsmith. Again, like a pretty good defender, he just gets around him. I think it was absolutely terrific. Like, this is the kind of stuff that I'm sure that you, I can see a world where you were not quite as high on RJ coming into the draft, right?
I didn't know. That was like pre me having really a great understanding of that. I really liked RJ, because I watched that Duke team a lot that year. And I liked RJ a lot. I didn't really know what to make of him. He's somebody I've always just been really interested in and felt could be a really fun player.
I agree. No, and it's that power. It's that blend of power that he has. He's always needed the jumper. I hope that this is a fix long-term for the jumper. To me, that's going to be the thing. If this is a fix long-term for the jumper, he has something here. Again, here you go. It's just an easy kick out for RJ. Made shot. Again, this is going to be, I believe, just another reversal up to the top. He's just taking them confidently. Like, when was the last time you saw RJ Barrett take threes like this in rhythm as confidently as he is?
I'll get back to you when I have a date.
But it's been a while, right?
Yeah.
It's definitely been a while, so it's really good to see this. And then here we go. RJ just going to kind of reverse, and he's going to spin. He's going to work his way in the lane, and he's going to finish. This is the power again. This is what he's got. Connor Andrews in the YouTube comments brings up those Leonard Miller long steps by RJ. It's those long strides that Leonard's got. I love it, man. I absolutely love it. But that's it, right? That's what this is. This is that RJ Barrett looks a lot more comfortable and confident. And I think he's feeding off of the jumper now in a substantial way. He feels more confident in the jumper. And when that jumper goes, I think the Knicks are a different team. And I think he's a different player, which allows him to stay on the court and be a really valuable player. Because look, there were times throughout the course of the season, I wondered, are the Knicks sometimes better without him late in games, especially when Emmanuel Quickley is rolling, right? Like, if you can play Brunson, Quickley, Hart, and Grimes together with Julius Randle, or you play two bigs with three of those guys, that can sometimes leave out RJ. And Emmanuel Quickley was amazing throughout the course of the regular season, but without him being as good as he is, the Knicks have desperately needed RJ. And seeing him take this leap over the course of realistically the last five games, I would say, is really important for the Knicks, both now and moving forward.
Yeah, no, 100%, man.
Okay. Let's get to the last two topics on our list. Let's talk about Joel Embiid winning MVP first. Joel Embiid is your MVP. Mark, he was your choice for MVP. Does this make you happy to see Joel Embiid win the MVP award?
Yeah, I think it was awesome to see that. I think my initial reaction whenever somebody wins something, unless they're like an absolutely shit person, is to just be happy for them. So I think it's hard for me to look at this and not be happy for Joel. Like, it's the best season of his career. He's played at an MVP level the last couple of seasons. That doesn't mean that, you know, like, I am disputing other MVPs. Like, I think that any given year there can be multiple guys who are deserving. And I think this is the right choice. Like, I'm very happy with him. I would have been cool with others, but again, Joel was my choice, and I just hope that he can get healthy and get to continue showing out in the playoffs. But also, even if he doesn't get to, that's not an indictment of what he did this season. So I'm just very thrilled for him.
Yeah, no, I'm thrilled for Joel Embiid too.
Especially when you think about the fact that, you know, like, it's easy to get lost in the moment of, you know, what he is now. But looking back at waiting 2 years for him to play, all the injuries he dealt with, you know, just throughout his career, a lot of uncertainty in general, and just to see him get to this point, I don't want to call it the pinnacle of his career because he's still young. Like, you know, there's primes are different for everyone. But just to see him get to have this moment is really cool.
I completely agree with you. And if you remember with Joel Embiid, he came into the NBA with real injury concerns. He missed the first 2 years of his career, essentially, with injury concerns. He was taken at the top of that draft in 2014. And there was real skepticism about if he was ever going to reach his prime, not due to talent. Everybody knew that this guy was an unbelievable, you know, once in a generation mover in terms of fluidity for someone that's 7'2" and 250 pounds at that time. Everybody knew that that's what was possible for him. So to see him actualize it always just makes me really happy. Like, you're never going to see me like clown somebody for winning MVP. I personally would have voted for Giannis. I said that on the award show that Mark and I did, but that doesn't mean I'm not ecstatic. I think Joel is a more than worthy winner of MVP. Like,
can I load up on something else really quick?
Yeah, of course.
You and I talked about this mostly not on here, just because we tend to try and find ways to talk more about things positively and just highlight the basketball. This MVP discussion in yours has been ridiculous on all fronts. And I just need fans to, A, as I mentioned on the pod last week, touch grass. B, recognize that pull quotes, 15-second video clips and bullshit on social media are not the full embodiment of a player in person. I just get like so annoyed, and I mean, it was both with Jokic and with Joel. Like, I think you could very clearly see fans anytime that there was a quote from Joel after he'd undoubtedly been asked the same question 17 times and finally somebody an answer. Like, the award doesn't mean something to me, blah, blah, blah. Like, can somebody certainly say something pointed in the media? For sure. But also, I just think making so much out of things is incredibly annoying. Like, you don't know the guy. He's not showing you himself for the most part, most likely. Anyways, and it's just stupid. We're talking about MVP of a professional sports league. Like, why does that become this giant thing? So I just find it very annoying. Just be happy for people and pull your head out of your ass.
So I do think it's important. I will say that. Like, I think that these things are incredibly important.
No, yeah, it's like important. I just mean, like, everything. Grand scheme like, of everything, like, this MVP discussion this season and the way that fans have been about it is not important, and it's stupid, like the way that people have approached it.
We certainly don't condone attacking like other fans like we saw throughout the course of this year. And I think that like while I think very differently about basketball from other people, and I think that people will overvalue analytics regularly, like these one number analytic points, right? These all-inclusive stats. Most of the people bringing them up can't even name the numbers that go into the stats oftentimes. I would prefer that MVP would be voted on by people that know what they're talking about. I've expanded. I have gone on at length before about how I would love to see the MVP and all of the award conversations be expanded and all of the voting bodies be expanded. Like, I think there is a world where we should be including players in this discussion. Like, people will talk often about how, oh my God, you see some of the all-star votes that some people give out. Guys, there are so many basketball junkies that are professional players. Some of them aren't. Some of them play professional basketball in the NBA because they like the lifestyle and they like the paycheck and they like everything that comes with it. But there are many more are pure basketball junkies that just fucking love the game and would love the ability to vote on MVP, I think, and would love the idea of maybe not necessarily voting in one way or another on their own peers or for their teammates or something like that. But I think that they would very genuinely take it seriously because they care about this stuff. They do. It matters within their contract structures. It matters within all of these discussion points. I would love to see players involved. I think there's a world to involve like front offices and coaches in some way. Let those guys get a voice. Let the media continue to have a voice. Like, I'm all for that as well. I think that the media does have, if you take it seriously as a media person, like Mark and I do, you can have a real gauge of the entire league. And I think that's important as well. So I think that these conversations are really important. I also think that we need to be just very understanding about like the fact that social media is in very real terms, probably killing our brain on some level. And it makes it a lot easier for people's voice to get out there and to get probably expanded in a way that it used to not be able to get expanded when you were just bullshitting with your friends at the bar. And look, I go to the bar and bullshit with my friends regularly. I'm here for it. I love the fact that that also continues to be an option. But at the same token, we need to understand that like you can't say the same things at the bar that you're saying like publicly in Twitter. I mean, look, I guess I do, but like I'm not a dickhead. I guess. So look,
depends on the day.
Be a little bit more cognizant of what you're saying online. Be a little bit more cognizant of the way that these conversations come off. And frankly, just be happy for people, right? Like I said, like I wouldn't have voted for Joel, but I'm fucking ecstatic for that guy, man. Like it's an amazing story. This kid came from Cameroon and like picked up basketball late. And is just such an incredible player and is such an incredible personality within basketball. I don't know how you can't be anything but just thrilled for this guy. I love it. I absolutely adore it. Congrats to Joel. It's amazing. I would have voted Joel number two. When we did awards, I said that I thought Joel and Giannis were 1A and 1B this year, and I think that a vote for either is completely justified, completely valid. Whatever you want to do is your choice as a voter. I'm just excited. I'm ecstatic for Giannis, and I'm ecstatic for Joel. I'm not ecstatic for Giannis. Giannis finished third in this vote, but I am ecstatic for Joel just across the board. The last thing I want to talk about, Dylan Brooks news. Sean Strania, my colleague over at The Athletic, he reported earlier today that Dylan Brooks will, I believe it was, not be on the Memphis Grizzlies next season under any circumstances. My guess on that was that the under any circumstances was Shams phrasing, not necessarily the phrasing of somebody else within whatever sourcing that he talked about. When you saw this report, Mark, what was your immediate reaction?
Wow. Yeah, basically like the Kobe White at the draft. I think what was so difficult in this entire thing is like seeing it go from where we were at, you know, a year ago to where it's at now. Saying I'm not surprised sounds like asinine. Like, I think the wording was surprising. But it culminating to hear, you know, especially after we got, Taylor talking about, during a presser before whatever game, I can't remember which game it was, but you know, talking about how they needed to be more focused and not as distracted, and it was very clearly like we knew who he was talking to, and then Dylan has like the quote after the game, like, oh, you know, I'm gonna keep doing me, like I'm not gonna stop being me. I don't want to misquote him, but it was along those lines, and then obviously that continued to carry on and. I do want to add too, as much as I don't love whatever the wording was from whoever decided to put that out there. Not even that I don't love the wording, like that's just extremely strong wording without having your name attached to it. That's what I'll say. I think that there's just, that stuff can be tricky. With anonymity in who's releasing things. I think people who are looking at this as Dylan Brooks got scapegoated is kind of missing this just for the sake of a talking point, if we're being real. I do very much think that it is fair to not love how that came out, but also worth noting, okay, Dylan was very much so a distraction. Dylan was also awful in this series and really struggled much of the season. I would also point people to go read the Michael Cole story from over at Commercial Appeal, who covers the Memphis Grizzlies. He does an awesome job. He wrote a really great story on this as well, basically giving a lot more backstory to this. Dylan Brooks wants a bigger role than he had this season. His usage really dropped this year. His field goal attempts dropped this year. He gave very pointed quotes about how he doesn't want to be a role player, how he's capable of doing a lot more, how he could have had more plays run for him during the series. That is very much not how I view Dylan Brooks in this capacity and what he's capable of or what he should have been getting with Memphis. And I think, you know, you and I both talked about how weird his role was this season, how it kind of got jerked all over the place. And especially like when they were dealing with injuries, I mean, he had to carry the offense at times and that was ugly. And, but I also just want to say too, like it's in a really weird spot of, this team very much needed Dylan Brooks and relied on him a ton the last couple of years. And I think this is the first season where they really hit a point where it's like, you know, we need something different that isn't what you're bringing. At least not in the capacity that you want to. And, yeah, so it's – I know that's a million different thoughts at the same time, but the last thing I would wrap out on that is I saw a lot of takes of like, oh, you know, I wouldn't sign Dylan. I don't want Dylan Brooks on my team for, you know, any amount of money, this and that. And like, I think that Dylan 1000% needs to do some soul searching. Like that is, that goes without saying. But I also think like he is an all defense level defender. I think with his shot selection reined in, that's still an incredibly impactful rotation player. Whether or not he wants to be that, that's up to him to find out. I wonder what the market's going to be like. I do think it's going to be a lot more than a lot of people thought or wanted to put out on the timeline today or just in speaking today. And then the last thing I want to hit on, just in general, I do wish that some of the language and stuff that got used in decisions here are things that we talked about with people who actually do bad things instead of somebody who just talks a lot of bullshit. Like,
yeah.
That's, I think, what I came away most frustrated with about today. Like, okay, well, where is this for dudes who are very clearly doing things that are bad that get swept under the rug by everybody in every facet in basketball? So yeah, that's it. I don't want to say it is what it is because that's too callous for me. But yeah. I do think that's something that very much needs to change and be better.
So the first thing that came to mind to me was, hey, remember when Draymond Green said earlier this season, the dynasty starts after you, not with you, to Dylan Brooks in a podcast?
I forgot about that. Wow, that is
unbelievable shit crazy. From Draymond Green. That is some incredible trash talk. Unbelievable. Just the king of our time, Draymond Green. The second thing I thought of was that DeMichael Cole story, obviously. And Dylan Brooks on Sunday was quoted as saying, I was just there to 3-and-D, shoot, and play defense. I got way more to my game than that. I don't think he does on the NBA level, just to be real about it. I don't. I think he is a 3-and-D guy that takes a lot of very difficult pull-up mid-range jumpers that just absolutely do not work for him. I think that he is not a good enough shooter on those shots to be taking as many of them as he does. Having said that, he is one of the best on-ball defenders in the NBA. And a team like Dallas should love him. Like, if I was Dallas, I would be trying to get a sign-and-trade for Dylan Brooks going. Like, I would love that. That makes a whole world of sense. Give them all sorts of attitudes, some defensive energy, some aggression, the ability to move Kyrie off the ball, the ability to limit difficult matchups for Kyrie and Luka. Team like that would be great. There are a number of them out there that would be valuable. 100%. I think that Dylan Brooks will get paid by somebody this summer. Who that'll be, I don't know. What that number will be, I don't know. It could just be like a mid-level. I think that's a very real potential outcome for him. He is him just getting the mid-level from somebody. What I will also say is somebody who works in this industry and reports and generally tries not to report, frankly. I tend to know more than what I say on things because I don't like the stress that comes with reporting, frankly. A lot of the things that come across my desk, or proverbial desk, my phone, let's say realistically, do not necessarily have a strategic motive to them. And I think that often when reports like this happen, people try to ascribe strategy to things. And this isn't me saying that like from the Shams perspective. This is me saying this from like, you know, what camp perspective benefits from this, right? I think Shams is perfectly reasonable to have done what he did here. Like, this is not, I think Shams did great here. I have no beef with him in any way, shape, or form. Shams did what he is supposed to do in this job. People try to ascribe a strategic motive or goal to these reports often, because we're so used to, for instance, the NFL draft, where the NFL draft is an absolute shit show. And these football teams, I think, are just absolute like crazy people who try to smokescreen everything. And I don't really get why they do it. It happens in the NBA. Smokescreens certainly happen in the NBA. I don't think that everything is as strategic as people tend to think it is. Let me give you an example, right? I'm not saying this is the way Shams got it. I have no idea how Shams got this story. This is just me saying that a way that this could have happened theoretically, right? Of course, all of the players on the Memphis Grizzlies would be aware of this, that Dylan Brooks is not returning to the Memphis Grizzlies. It's not uncommon for teams to let players know during exit interviews that they won't be back next year. That's a reality of the situation. It is very possible that a player could have gone to their agent and said, oh shit, man, Dylan's not going to be back next year. And then Shams finds out about it that way, right? Other reporters find out about it that way. And then they go about, you know, confirming it from multiple different angles in any way, shape, and form that you can confirm it as a reporter. Again, I think that totally everything Shams did here is perfect. But that's not like a strategic thing. That hypothetical example is not a strategic way of this news getting out, right? That's just like a player telling an agent, like, hey, yeah, this is going to happen. And then the agent, you know, bullshitting with the reporter saying, hey, yeah, like this is the thing that's happening. And then it kind of leaking out that way. In this case, it was strange to me to see that so many people immediately ascribed this as negative toward the Memphis Grizzlies. The way it came out was a little bit weird. And because Dylan Brooks is such a lightning rod, it became a lightning bolt of news coverage, right? And it became a storm. I don't think this actually benefits the Memphis Grizzlies at all for this to be out there. In fact, I think it could actually hinder their potential offseason plans, because what they could do theoretically is they could try and involve Dylan Brooks in like a sign-in trade in some way. But with this being out there now, like, is Dylan going to acquiesce to trying to help out the Memphis Grizzlies? Maybe not, right? Like, that might not be a thing. If he wants to get to a specific spot that doesn't have cap space, maybe it will. But it might make that a little bit more complicated now. Typically, leaks that come out, you know, in this circumstance, if you're trying to ascribe blame in some way, you would be ascribing that blame based off of strategy in some way. I don't think that it benefits Memphis for this to come out in any way. So I don't know why people would think, you know, oh, the front office, they leaked this just to say a fuck you and a last, like, screw you to Dylan Brooks. That doesn't line up to me. Just logically, that doesn't line up to me. And obviously, it doesn't line up necessarily for, like, Dylan Brooks's side to want this out there in some way, right? You want to keep leverage against opposing teams, to even if it's true that Memphis is not going to re-sign Dylan Brooks. You want to be able to hold that card over an opposing team because they have his bird rights. And them having his bird rights means that they can exceed the salary cap to sign him, which means they can sign him to the biggest number. So doesn't necessarily help anyone here that this is out. So I say all this to say, I don't know why there was a rush from media people to be like, oh my God, why is this out there? Or like, oh my God, the Memphis Grizzlies, they absolutely screwed Dylan Brooks here. We have no idea who the sourcing was on this story. I certainly don't. I don't want to ask Shams. Like, I don't want to know that. Shams wouldn't tell me, and he shouldn't tell me. Like, I think that there is such a rush to look for a strategic angle in reporting oftentimes. And there is such a rush to put on the tinfoil hat and go full conspiracy theorist in some way that sometimes, like, people try and have these ideas that are not always true. And I don't know if something is true. I don't know what's true in this circumstance. I'm just saying that this news being out does not benefit the Memphis Grizzlies. Like, just straight up, they got shit on all day from media people. And it, like, actually does not help their, like, long-term potential offseason plans. So why in the world, like, why is everybody jumping to that conclusion, I guess, is what I would ask you, Mark.
I mean, it just, that's not typically how things get reported, you know, or not even like, or I should say, like, that's just not typically the wording you see. Like, that is, that was different. So I think that's why people jumped on it. I didn't really know what to make of it when it first came out, other than, holy shit, you know, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really have anything else to add on that, because I don't, exactly like you mentioned, I think there's a lot more ins and outs to it than I know about. So it's definitely something.
Yeah. And again, I want to be clear here. I think Shams did a great job here. Like, this is news. This is absolutely his job. Like, shout out to Shams. Him reporting this news is great. Like, anything I say here is not about Shams giving the initial report. The initial report is great. It's about the reaction to the initial report and trying to ascribe these beliefs from other people. And I don't know why there was a jump to conclusion to shit on Memphis in this circumstance, when it doesn't benefit them. And we have no idea who the sourcing is in this circumstance, right? That seems logical.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Dylan Brooks, like, do you have a fit for Dylan Brooks moving forward that you like?
At the moment, no. I feel like it, you know, once that's the kind of thing where, like, especially with how much things can change in the off season, I'd need to see it before I have a feel. But right now, no, I'd probably say no.
Yeah. It's not the easiest thing in the world to find, like, a phenomenal fit for him. I do wonder, like, what if you put him in Miami? Like, I wonder if that culture, like, would actually kind of, like, I don't know, kind of even it out a little bit in some way. I don't know. I'm just, like, spitballing here. I think Dallas, like, really fits. Like, I actually really love that idea. That was my one that I was like, oh yeah, this makes a world of sense. Like, Dallas goes for it. But yeah, I thought the news cycle today was a bit bizarre and kind of wanted to talk about it a little bit more. And I think that Mark's 100% right, by the way. The thing that was very strange was, it's not strange, I guess, to, like, get off jokes at Dylan Brooks' expense. Dylan Brooks has been, he has embraced being a wrestling heel at this point, right? So, like, when you do that, you open yourself up to criticism, like, undeniably. But I agree with Mark. Keep the same energy, for instance, if Miles Bridges signs somewhere this offseason, right? Like, go harder at Miles Bridges, by all means, please. Based off of what he, you know, pled to in his agreement. So I agree with Mark wholeheartedly there. Okay. Mark, do you have anything else you want to add before you want to go to bed?
Honestly, I think that's it on my end. Not just to cut us short, but yeah, no, I don't have anything else to add on him.
Well, I meant, like, any takes, anything you have to get off your chest at this point, Mark, before we leave.
At this point.
Any movie takes, any playoff takes, what do you got? Do you have something exciting? Or we can just go. That's easy too.
I watched Super 8 again. I loved seeing, that was one of the movies I saw. I grew up like 10 minutes from a drive-in theater when I was a kid. So
that rules.
I saw movies there all the time during the summer. Super 8, I went and saw that opening night. And absolutely loved it when I was a kid. I still really liked it. This is the first time I watched it in probably 5 or 6 years. It was one of those things that I would always watch it when it came on, you know, network TV. But first time I really sat down with the intention of watching it again. And I think it was good, but it was like oddly one of those movies where I felt like I came away wishing it was longer, which I don't feel often for movies. Because it's really good. And I love the story. And I love the way that, like, I think there's really good performances in it. But also it's just like kind of rushed. I wish that there was more in it because I wanted to know more and get more from it. And it's one of the things where very much like everything with J.J. Abrams, I just wish that I had gotten even more of the story. And yeah, we never did. So I, you know, it's been what, 12 years since it came out. So I'm under the assumption that we are not going to get anything, anything new on that, but would be cool. Other follow-up, I rewatched today before the playoffs started. I rewatched the 2006 star-studded classic Over the Hedge. Cinema.
What is that?
You've never seen Over the Hedge? It's incredible. Very good movie. It's a DreamWorks production.
Okay.
Very good. It's a no-nonsense 80-minute animated movie that is tremendous. It's basically about Bruce Willis.
Oh, God. This came out when I was like 16. Jesus.
Yeah. So that's probably why it didn't hit for you.
No. You were four.
No, in 2006?
How old were you?
I would have been, because I think when seven, it came out, maybe. I was eight, I think, when it came out. But no, this is awesome.
You're not that much younger than me. I always fuck around with that.
Because I had the game on GameCube. They had like a game for it, and I had it on GameCube, and it was sick. But like, no, long story short, this raccoon who is very trickstery is trying to steal food from this bear while he's hibernating. Turns out the bear's like a vicious killer. The raccoon ends up like fucking up with his food stash, and he gets a week to recover it, and then, you know, runs in this other group of animals, gets their help, unbeknowing to them that he's going to take this food to the bear because he owes him. It's really good. It's funny. The cast is awesome. Highly recommend. It's on Netflix. So I don't know if it's on Netflix in Australia, but recommend. You're muted.
I have American Netflix as well. I can figure out Netflix. I watched Infernal Affairs a couple weeks ago on Indian Netflix. It was the best. Interesting. I don't know that I will watch this, Mark, to be honest with you.
I do.
This looks very silly.
It is very silly.
Whenever I'm trying to find something to watch, I'm sure I can find something that is silly, but there are too many things that I can find typically.
Sometimes I just need something chill to watch, you know? So
I agree with that. I do agree with that for sure. I think that's all I got, honestly. I don't have a whole lot else to say. Tomorrow, next episode, we will be doing a mock draft podcast with Adam Spinella. Spins will be back. Spins and I have not talked draft for, God, it feels like 3 or 4 weeks. So we will be back tomorrow on YouTube, probably earlier than what we typically do, because Adam would prefer to spend time with his wife, I'm sure. I would also like to spend time with my wife. So we're going to do that tomorrow. It will be during the day at some point, you know, evening, probably East Coast time. Friday that'd be Wednesday in the United States, right, Mark? Tomorrow is Wednesday in the United States?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Thursday, there will not be a podcast in the United States. Friday, there will be a podcast in the United States. Saturday, there will likely not be a podcast in the United States. 5 days, you know, that was the goal for the playoffs, 5 days a week. Sunday in Australia, Saturday in the US. My wife's birthday is this week. We're going out and like doing the whole thing. Yeah. We're gonna like spend a day out on Sunday, which will be great, and we're super excited about it. So no podcast Sunday. We'll be back Saturday in the US, Sunday in Australia. We'll be back Sunday, probably with another spin show, draft, playoffs, who the hell knows at that point, right? I would imagine combine invites will probably be out by then. I have a pretty good feel on who's invited and who's not, but I would like a full list before we talk about it. I know probably most agents, but not all agents. So I've been able to get a like complete accounting of who is invited. Yeah, so that's the schedule moving forward. Podcast tomorrow, no podcast Thursday, podcast Friday, no podcast Saturday in the United States. We will be back again Sunday after that. So keep it locked on the YouTube channel. That's the best place for you to know when we are live, when we are podcasting, when we're doing things. Please, by all means, subscribe, hit that like button, do anything you can to support the show in that way. Hit the subscribe button over on Apple, Spotify. It's the best way to know when we are live, when we're talking about shit from the playoffs, when we're talking about shit for the offseason, for the draft, anything like that. We're going to keep going. I think that's about all I've got, though, Mark. Tell the people where they can find your work, please.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at MG underscore Schindler. Subscribe to my Patreon. That really helps me to stay active and keeping stuff going. I have a couple podcasts that are linked in there as well. I'm all over the place, but yeah, Twitter is the best place to find me.
Totally agree. You should go follow Mark on Twitter, MG underscore Schindler. I released a top 100 board NBA draft today. You will be able to follow along with me as I make picks tomorrow on the podcast by following that board. You can get that board by clicking the link that I have posted over on Twitter and hitting that subscribe button. Once you get there, go to The Athletic, subscribe on one of my articles. That is a terrific way to keep me employed over there. I enjoy working over there with those people, so it is very fun. I will be back Thursday writing, I believe, as well. I should have a redraft of the 2022 NBA draft, a really, really fun project that I do at the end of every season, going back and looking at different things we've seen from rookies, trying to extrapolate future value out based on what we've seen. It's very fun. Until next time, though, folks, we will talk soon.